In His Grip with Dr. Chuck Betters of Mark Inc. Ministries. Today we are reaching back into the archives. Today's message is titled, Satan's Deep Dark Secrets, from the series Unveiling and Understanding Revelation. Each message is designed to help turn your heart towards Jesus and equip you to walk by faith. Let's join Dr. Betters in the sanctuary.
We are going to continue our look today at the letters to the seven churches, remembering that as we come to chapters 1, 2, and 3 of the book of Revelation, we have the first of the progressive parallelisms that the book is written in, telling the same story in different ways with varying intensity as we look at the book of Revelation as one all-encompassing story told seven different ways. Again, as I remind you, the book of Revelation is not in chronological order. In other words, as each progressive section ends, a new one picks up but tells the same story, only with different symbols. So now we're looking at the time period between the first coming of Christ and the second coming of Christ, best described for us in chapters 2 and 3 as God unveils these messages to these seven churches. Now, I do not believe the seven churches are seven church ages, although I believe you will find the characteristics of these seven churches throughout the age of Christendom. I believe you will find Pergamenium churches and Thyatiran churches and Ephesian churches and Sardis churches scattered all around the world. Many of the characteristics of several of the churches are engulfing some of our congregations. But as we look at these seven letters, we remember that they exist, these seven churches exist in every age. However, the letters of chapters 2 and 3 were addressed to specific congregations. And in so doing, God uses the topography and the demographics of the area in which the church was located to bring home the message in symbols that the people of those cities would understand. Remember the letter to the church at Ephesus, the city of change, the city that constantly was changing. And in that particular letter, God used that consistent change principle to bring home the message to the Ephesian Christians that they had left their first love. You remember the letter to Smyrna, the city of life, the crown of Asia. You remember the letter to the church at Pergamum, the city of authority, the capital of the province of Asia. Today we come to the letter of Thyatira, probably the longest of the seven letters, and yet the one city that we know most about, or least about, I should say, is the city of Thyatira. There is very little in recorded history about the city of Thyatira. And there's a reason for that. The reason was it was the least important of all the cities in Asia. None of the cities were as unimportant as Thyatira. The reason was it connected the capital, which was Pergamum, to the rest of the world. Thyatira was the city that formed what we call the garrison, or the first line of attack. It existed in order to protect Pergamum. The city, because of its topography, was a city that was not very safe to be in if you were a soldier. It was, for all intents and purposes, a military town, and they existed for one reason and one reason only: so that if anyone decided to attack Pergamum, the capital, they would have to go through Thyatira first, and so Thyatira formed the first line of defense. However, because the way the city was laid out, it was very dangerous to be a soldier in that city. They oftentimes were brutally beaten, yet always the city was rebuilt because it was a first line of defense. A true military town, a transient culture, an immoral culture, a fearful culture, a fearful place to be, for at any moment, Pergamum could be attacked, and they would have to come through Thyatira to get there. They were never able to fight anything but a delaying action to give the troops in Pergamum time to assemble so as to defend themselves. Literally, thousands and thousands of soldiers died in Thyatira simply because they were sitting ducks while Pergamum assembled. It was a commercial city. We read about it in Acts chapter 16 when one Lydia, who was a dye maker or a seller of purple, came from the city of Thyatira. She was a businesswoman. And so we know, at least from some of the fragments of recorded history, that Thyatira marketed fabrics and dyes, and also specialized in the making of an alloy that was a combination of bronze and gold, a bronze-gold alloy that they used to make weapons. They were known for their trade guilds or their unions in Thyatira. Membership in these trade guilds was secret, and this is going to prove to be a very important point later on in the message. There was a secret membership to be a member of one of these trade guilds or these unions, and the membership was held in pagan temples. Only the members of these trade guilds would get the business. Literally, your livelihood depended on whether or not you were a member of one of the trade unions in Thyatira. They were religiously neutral in Thyatira. There was no Caesar worship there. There was no Greek worship there. They didn't really care what you believed. They didn't really care what you did as far as your worship was concerned. And so, therefore, the Christians, unlike the city of Smyrna, were not persecuted from the outside. There was no one telling them that they couldn't be Christians or serve the Christ of the Christian faith. Nobody put any limitations on them in that respect. But the persecution came not from outside the church. The persecution to the Christians came from inside the church, as you're going to see in just a moment. It did possess, Thyatira did, one fortune-telling shrine presided over by a female prophetess known as the Samboth. She would tell your fortune for a fee. You think these shops up and down Route 13 are something new? They're not. And it's very possible, some historians tell us, that that fortune-telling shrine was a syncretistic blending of Judaism with some form of paganism. Somebody decided, well, we'll take the best elements of Judaism and the best elements of some of the Greek fortune-telling cults, we'll put it together. And there are some who believe that that shrine in Thyatira was the syncretistic blend of those two religious concepts. At the time of the writing of the book of Revelation, Thyatira was on the upswing. The city was entering into one of its eras of financial prosperity. They were a city that their prosperity financially depended on whether or not they were being attacked. It was a war economy. And in that particular setting, this particular setting in Revelation 2, the city was on the upswing. They were experiencing great amounts of work. The bronze workers were heavily involved. The trade unions were flourishing at the time of the writing. And so the money was pouring in to the city. And in the midst of that sits a church that had been lulled to sleep. A congregation that had fallen to sleep at the hands of one Jezebel. You see, they had a root problem in Thyatira. The root problem goes something like this. To be involved in these trade unions created two problems. Number one, the rituals that were held were called common meals. So if you wanted to be a member of this trade union, you would have to go into one of their secret ritualistic temples and participate in what they called the common meal. Oftentimes, those common meals, secondly, would end up in drunken orgies, sexual immorality, loose behavior, slack immorality, and revelry. So the Christian was faced with a real problem. Either I join this trade union, participate in those common meals, subject myself to that kind of immorality, or I starve. I don't get any work. I'm blackballed, so to speak. There was no threat of persecution from without the church, but the threat was coming from within the church. Because you see, inside of that congregation at Thyatira, there were some who were saying, "What is wrong with a little compromise to earn a buck? What's wrong with bowing down to this kind of thing? They're not asking us to worship any god in particular. They just want us to join the trade union. What's the big deal? We go in, we pay our respects, we burn a little incense, we join the union, put our name down on the membership card. What's the big deal as long as we can earn a buck?" But then there were other Christians who had a real problem with eating meat that had been offered to idols and participating in such a paganistic way and seemingly violating their convictions in order to earn some money. You see, they faced a real difficult dilemma. We still have the same problem today. Christians face this all the time. How far, if at all, do we go in compromising with the world without violating the standards of what we believe as Christians? Notice the letter in verse 18, chapter 3, or chapter 2, and verse 18. To the angel in the church at Thyatira write, "These are the words of the Son of God, whose eyes are like blazing fire and whose feet are like burnished bronze." The eyes of fire, the feet of bronze, taken directly, by the way, from Daniel chapter 10, verse 6, where it speaks of the gaze of God stripping away all of our pretense and his feet showing us how immovable his law is. It's interesting he would use the analogy of bronze to a city that specialized and to trade unions that specialized in making this bronze alloy. So he references Daniel 10:6, and he says to them, "My eyes are watching. My law is immovable. My standard is pure." By the way, any letter that begins this way is not designed to be some sort of soothing tranquilizer, but a warning and an exhortation. You can sense as the letter opens that the Son of God is about to say something that will impact the lives of these people and radically change them forever. This is what the Son of God says. "My eyes are burning, my feet and my law is immovable." Then he commends them. Look at verse 19. "I know your deeds, your love, your faith, your service, your perseverance, and that you are now doing more than you did at first." Service as the outcome of love. He says, "I know your deeds, your love." The fruit of their love, deeds, works, labors. More at that time than when the church was first started. Endurance is the product of loyalty. And at least certain things that were better in the church at the point of the writing than when the church had begun. You see, this congregation was a hive of energy and activity that created a restless ferment in the congregation rather than a haven of peace. This was a busy church. They were involved in a lot of things. There was a lot of activity. There are many churches today you can walk into that are hives of activity. There are programs up and down the calendar, things going on, service-oriented projects, mission projects, outreach projects. Certainly there are churches that are busting at the seams with activity. Yet from within, they have caved in to the deep secrets of Satan, as the Thyatiran church did. And so he says, I know your deeds. I know what's going on. I know the activity of your church. I know what you're doing. I know that many, many aspects of your church life is better now than it ever was. But he says, I've got a problem. If you look at verse 20 and 21, you'll find the source of the error. Nevertheless, I have this against you. You tolerate that woman, Jezebel, who calls herself a prophetess. By her teaching, she misleads my servants into sexual immorality and the eating of food sacrificed to idols. I have given her time to repent of her immorality, but she is unwilling. That woman, Jezebel. Now, there are different translations as to what that means. Different commentators believe different things about who this woman Jezebel was. Some say, well, it really means that Jezebel of a woman. In other words, they're referencing the wife of Ahab in the Old Testament who had certain characteristics to her. And they're saying that this woman in Thyatira had the same characteristics of Jezebel. But her name really wasn't Jezebel. Some people say she was a Jezebel of a woman. And there are others who say, well, that this was a specific woman in the congregation. Some have maintained that she was the fortune-telling prophetess, the Samboth in the temple. I don't believe any of those things are accurate because I believe, first of all, he references her as that woman, Jezebel. That woman, Jezebel. Now, when you look at that in the Greek, one of the things that you will discover is that the word for woman, and by the way, I've warned my wife of this before I say this, that word for woman is the same word for wife. The words are used interchangeably. And literally, the translation can be, your wife, Jezebel. Now, who was the letter written to? Well, we see in verse 18, to the angel of the church at Thyatira, which initially we have told you, the good possibility here is that the letters were addressed to the pastors of the churches. And if you put all of that together, it's very clear who this Jezebel woman was. She was the wife of the pastor. Now, don't you any of you start calling my wife Jezebel. But from within the church, Jezebel had established her roots. And from her ministry, she was destroying the church with the deep secrets of Satan. However it is translated, this woman was the culprit. And certainly her character and even her name brings up to us the images of the Old Testament Jezebel. You remember her, the wife of King Ahab, the persecutor of Elijah the prophet? You remember how Elijah brought the prophets of Baal on top of Mount Carmel and called fire down from heaven and had them all killed? And as the result of that, Jezebel set out for his life, set the prophet Elijah into hiding, persecuting the man of God. When she came to Ahab as his wife, she brought with her all of the gods of Sidon, and she caused Ahab and Israel to worship them. By the way, it's interesting to note that the Old Testament Jezebel had a goal. Her goal was not to eliminate the worship of Jehovah. Her goal was not to eliminate the worship that the Jews were involved with. She didn't want to eliminate, she just wanted to add on the worship of some of the false gods. She wasn't there to eliminate Israel's worship of God, but to add to Israel's worship of God, the worship of Baal. So in the process, she slew the prophets of God who dined at her table. And with the 450 prophets of Baal as her honored guest, she left behind a legacy of harlotry and witchcraft. What did this Jezebel at Thyatira do? Look at verse 20. It says, who calls herself a prophetess, by her teaching she misleads my servants into sexual immorality and the eating of food offered to idols. What was the sin of this Jezebel in the Thyatiran church? She misled the people of God. Do you want to know how she did this? She enticed them into the so-called gray areas. of the Christian faith. Not the black and white issues, but the gray areas. Antinomianism is a belief that the grace of God is what really is important and that you can abuse that grace in any way. It doesn't matter what you do because it's all covered by the grace of God. So go ahead and dive into those gray areas. Water down the faith. Add to the Christian faith the worship of Baal. Because the grace of God, they say, will cover it. Antinomianism. This problem was prevalent, by the way, in the Corinthian church as well. When you go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 8, and you notice verses 1 through 3 of 1 Corinthians 8, they had the same problem in the Corinthian church. Here were people who came to know Christ out of a pagan culture. And they were confronted with the question, is it right for us to eat meat that has been offered to idols? Go back to 1 Corinthians, hold your place in Revelation, and look with me at chapter 8. Same identical problem existed there. 1 Corinthians 8, he says, now about food sacrificed to idols, we know that we all possess knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. The man who thinks he knows something does not yet know as he ought to know, but the man who loves God is known by God. So then, about eating food sacrificed to idols, we know that an idol is nothing at all in the world and that there is no God but one God, etc., etc. And he goes on to develop in chapter 8 a principle. The principle goes something like this. Eating the meat in and of itself, there is nothing wrong with that. There is nothing wrong with eating meat that has been sacrificed to idols. But there is a problem if eating that meat causes another brother who is a newer Christian to stumble. There is a problem if that other brother looks at your behavior and says you're no different than the rest of the world, is offended by that, and is caused to trip, is caused to fall. What Paul is saying at that point is, if it causes another brother to stumble, you sin against your brother, you wound his weak conscience, you sin against Christ, and then he says in verse 13, therefore, if what I eat causes my brother to fall into sin, I'll never eat meat again, so that I will not cause him to fall. There's a higher principle. If entering into the gray area causes your brother to fall, then make it a black and white area. If somebody stumbles and trips because they watch and observe your behavior, and it's a gray area, nothing may be wrong in what you're doing, but it's a gray area, then make it a black and white area because there's a higher principle. That is, your brother cannot stumble. You have a responsibility to the weaker brother. It's a tough principle. Lack of discretion in the gray areas will open the doors to compromise in the black and white areas. Joining a simple trade union in Thyatira opened the doors to all kinds of sexual immorality and moral compromise. Joining the trade union was not in of itself wrong, but what it opened the door to, what it caused them to enter into, what was the result of their involvement in these trade unions was that they compromised in areas that were clearly marked in Scripture as forbidden. Sexual immorality, unacceptable behavior. And you see what happens to the Thyatiran church as this continues, as they continue to compromise in the so-called gray areas, and more people begin to stumble. You see what happened to the Thyatirans? What abhorred them in the beginning became acceptable in the end. What they thought was wrong and knew was wrong in the beginning became acceptable behavior in the end. It's a tough balance. You see, all the Christians needed to do to win over the heathens of their society, they thought, was speak their language. We've got to learn to speak their language. And all that they had to do to speak their language was to give a little. The answer was to be flexible. Loosen up. Don't be so tight. Don't worry so much about being perfectly holy. And in the process, Jezebel led the church into a spiritual union with Satan himself and watered down the distinctiveness of the faith. For what she defined as the gray areas really were black and white issues. They simply were not agreeable to her. For you see, to Jezebel, the higher principle was earning the buck.
Thank you for listening to In His Grip, a ministry of Mark Inc. You just listened to the first part of Dr. Better's message titled Satan's Deep Dark Secrets from the series Unveiling and Understanding Revelation. You can download the full sermon at www.markinc.org. Visit us online at markinc.org, where you will find many free resources that offer help and hope to the hurting. Please help us keep In His Grip on the air with your gifts. Visit markinc.org, where you can safely give, or call us toll-free at 877-MARK-INC. No gift is too small. Thank you for listening and for your support.